WPFW, Washington.
Good evening and welcome to the Ruckus Caucus, live now. Live at Ben's Next Door. Next door to Ben's Chili Bowl, 12th and June. Mark, Terry, and Garland, three minds linked and locked in analysis, wit, and sagacity. Every Tuesday night, live. Live right here, 7 p.m. WPFW 89.3 FM. Welcome again, live with Terry, Mark, and Garland, and the Ruckus Caucus.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Ruckus Caucus right here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. My name's Garland Nixon and I'm here with
Terry D. Kester.
And with a guest tonight,
Michael Roberts from St. Louis.
Welcome, Michael. My hometown, St. Louis. Can we sing now?
Is Terry, I've got good news.
Nice, yeah.
Mark isn't here yet.
Hey, it's a show.
Let's
a
give
show.
Another round of applause.
Yeah. Knock my mic over. I got
Terry
so excited.
Terry and I will get a word in edgewise at least for a few
minutes.
At
least. Not to mention thoughts and profundity and sagacity.
Yes, particularly sagacity. Sagacity. That's our favorite term here on the Ruckus Caucus. We're here every Tuesday. Well, we're actually on the air every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. on 89.3 FM. Tonight, we are at Ben's Next Door, 1211 U Street, right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. Come on down and join us. We will be on the air till 8 p.m. Come on down, be part of the audience. We have a great guest tonight, Mr. Mike Roberts from St. Louis. He is one of the foremost African-American business... Excuse me, let me get rid of African-American. One of the foremost successful businessmen in the United States today. How you doing, Mr. Roberts?
Well, I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
And we got lots of important things to talk about.
What a great crowd you have here tonight.
Oh, yeah. a wild crowd, I'm sure.
Well,
okay.
They appear to be sober.
Yeah,
well, sure.
It gets wild. You know, about the seventh inning after about 10 beers, things
kind of
live.
This is the Ruckus Caucus.
That's
right. Come on, guys.
So we're going to talk, let's start by talking about a little bit about Mr. Roberts' background, tell you just a little bit, and then I will defer over to him. Mr. Roberts was born in St. Louis, and he went to public school.
That's correct.
I'm happy to say. Born into a middle-class family and has turned that into tremendous business success. You know, unlike George Bush, who, as we always say, was born on third base. And thought he hit a triple, right?
Yeah,
Mr. Roberts actually hit the ball out of the park himself. So let's, Mr. Roberts, thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Mm-hmm. And I heard so much about the two of you. So much so that I was concerned about coming tonight.
Yeah, I kind of was hoping you didn't hear the truth too much. Yeah.
Notwithstanding that, of course, I've seen you on Fox Business News, which, was scary.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it wasn't
for me because I was on Fox.
Well, it was equally scary when I was on Fox one night. And it was interesting because they were so busy trying to send me to the right when I am more of a centrist and slightly to the left. But, it was a good evening. We had a lot of discussions regarding the, what it's going to take to turn this country around, from a business standpoint. I used to be an entrepreneur. And I enjoyed that coming up. Right out of law school, when all my friends were moving to the suburbs, I moved two blocks from the projects, where I lived for 10 years. In my 20s, was elected to the city council, we call them aldermen there. And in the course of that, I recognized that, you know, a lot of my community was needing investment. People were leaving the core city areas and... I started to buy properties there.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, I started looking at other types of investments in the city, in my backyard, essentially. And I felt that there was no need to sit around and wait for somebody else to come in and try to make our community different or better or improve it, that actually it's our responsibility to do that. And so when Sears and Roebuck moved out of the inner city areas around the country, back in the late 70s, early 80s, my brother and I bought the Sears building on North Kings Highway in Martin Luther King and Page. And we converted it into probably the most diversified retail and office building, 200,000 square foot space building. Our floor now, the top floor, 50,000, houses my 76 companies, which includes 12 hotels, 4 full-power TV stations, a radio station, shopping centers. We own three city blocks in downtown St. Louis and a variety of other miscellaneous smaller businesses. So there was a time when I was an entrepreneur, but I think today I'm just a cold-blooded capitalist.
Ooh.
Are you sure he's in the right place, Carl?
Yeah, he's in the raucous car.
Yeah, Mark, your place is right down.
Yeah, that's right. Bad news for our listeners. Mark Levine has showed up, and he's here. I'm sure he's
going to
could
not find a place to park.
The old park story. Yeah, he's running out of
gas. The capitalist filled the lot.
The sun was in your eyes, and it was snowing, and it was uphill all the way.
It was.
Mush all the way.
Let me just mention and give Mike a little credit here, because you know, my hometown is St. Louis as well. And what he has done there is not just, you know, buy property and improve
it. I once visited there.
I mean, he has done some fantastic work there. And the city has been, you know, it's got a rocky situation. To begin with, it's one of the few cities in the United States that it has practically no tax base. I mean, the county is totally separate. So the little tiny area of the city itself has to raise its own taxes, which is always a problem. But what he did to the Sears building is phenomenal. I mean, that area was really in trouble, really downhill. The building itself is striking as renovated and everything else. He also converted and restored the Orpheum Theater, which is now doing concerts and theater and everything else. Beautiful job on that. And, you know, buildings downtown as well. I think there's a boutique hotel and some condo buildings. But, I mean, it's really, really, really been constructive. It's the kind of things and investments that we wish other people were making in this country and in the cities of this country. So personally, I thank you, Mike.
Well, Terry, you're absolutely right. It is important for those of us who live in our communities to really invest in our communities and not sit back and wait for someone else to do it. And it's risky, of course. And in that time, my brother and I had built a wireless phone company. We were a Sprint affiliate, probably the only African-American company in this country ever to have actually built and owned a phone company. We went public with it, and then we were rolled up eventually by Sprint. They bought us, in other words. Are you familiar with the sound of a roll-up? It's cha-ching, cha-ching. You know, from that, Steve and I were able to make our investments into our city, our core areas as well. And you mentioned the Sears building. Well, my dad, who is 89, drives there every day to help us in the accounting side. He's 39 years with the post office, retired. And when my brother and I were starting our business, he came in and said he was going to help out his kids. And he did, and he has. And we would always ask, Garland, I told you this story earlier, but we would always ask Dad, well, how much can we pay you for your work, your assistance? He said, we can't pay me anything. I asked why. He said it would affect his government pension. So I suggest anybody who has a retired bureaucrat in their family, hire them because you won't have to pay them.
There you go. That's a good answer.
How do you get one of these if you don't have one?
Well, here's my
adopt them, Kateri.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Okay.
The point that I want to raise, and I want to bring clarification to it, is that all Mr. Sears did was move out of my neighborhood and black neighborhoods around the country. So we don't call it the old Sears building. We call it the Victor Roberts building, named
all right.
after my dad.
All right. Okay.
Thank you. I have a question.
I wanted to ask you because one of the things that was done by George Bush and Barack Obama, started by George Bush, seen by Barack Obama, was to bail out the banks. The economy was going to hell in a handbasket. And, of course, there was the TARP program. And to this day, the Federal Reserve lends banks at practically zero. And we think you give them an easy business model. They just loan it out at 2, 3, 4%. But what I find fascinating, and my question for a businessman of your stature is, how important is it for a small business, growing business, to get regular loans from banks? And how are they doing now? Because it's my impression that banks that would loan to anybody when they could pack it up and sell it on Wall Street and not sign their names to it and not vouch for it, then they'd sell to anybody. But today they're hardly loaning to anybody because actually they have to do banking. They have to make sure that someone can repay their loan. They have to do what banks used to do for decades, but apparently they got out of the business now when they're packaging going to Wall Street. Can small businesses get loans today, or is that still a problem?
All right, that's a great question, and it's every complicated question requires a complicated answer, but let me simplify it this way. Let's go back to the first premise, and that is that the federal government provided resources to banks. We call it their bailout. Okay. But what really was happening, even though it was a bailout, was that banks had spent or lost their reserves. And if they don't maintain their reserves at the appropriate level, they can lose their license.
They can go bankrupt and out of business and have the FDIC take them over, too.
Exactly right. Well, first, so that money ended up going into their reserve, which built that that jar, if you will, or that, and so, or that silo, I should say. And once that was there, they could not necessarily take it out to lend it easily because they had to maintain their reserves. So they had to begin to build their company back up in order to do it. Now, here comes Sarbanes-Oxley and the regulators that are basically saying...
Just for those that don't know, I was working in Congress back when Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, so some people don't know what it is. This is the bill. It was actually largely a Democratic bill, although Republicans came along with it, that said if you're a CEO of a corporation or a CFO, a chief financial officer, you got to actually vouch for the things you sign that say the company's in good financial condition and you have adequate controls. And that what was happening is companies would just sign on to anything, and when Enron went bust, they said, oops, I didn't know what was going on. John Corzine has the same problem with MF Global. So what Sarbanes-Oxley was designed to do is to say if you're the head of a corporation and you sign that these are the books, that those really are the books, or you can be held personally and criminally responsible. I want people to know what it is because not everybody does. Go ahead.
Even though it's not on point with the banking issue, because the banking issue and the regulators, and I want to get back to Sarbanes for a moment, the banking issue is basically saying now because of the regulators – we have to have cash flow in order to make the loan. So if you are in a business, it's just getting started, but you may even have a building or an asset. And that asset is traditionally what we would use as our collateral, but the asset is not enough. You literally have to have cash flow. So if you're starting and you have no cash flow, then what does that tell you? Well, enter considerations like SBIC and the SBA and others who may guarantee your
loan.
Small
Business Administration.
To show that this is going on today. For example, I'm on the National Advisory Council for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. I was with the administrator for SBA. I was with the Secretary of Commerce, our new Secretary of Commerce, and a variety of
I think that's
others.
One of the departments Rick Perry wants to abolish.
He doesn't know.
He forgets.
Know, he can't
but I think that's one of them.
And I think that was number three.
That was the oops.
That's the one he couldn't remember.
Right.
But... with regard to Sarbanes-Oxley, one of the considerations that I put forth early on in this body was if you are a small business and you've borrowed money and you, through venture capital or angel capital, these are people, of course, who find ways to loan money to you if you have a business that is reasonable for them to invest in. There's always the need for an exit strategy in order to cash them out or yourself in some degree. Normally, that's when you go public. Well, Sarbanes-Oxley, as you well described it, has become so expensive that if you don't have a $1 billion business, you really cannot afford to go public. So one of the things that I put forth in Profit Today and several weeks ago was to create a Sarbanes-Oxley Lite, something that a small business, lesser than $1 billion, could actually go public without the restraints and the considerations that's necessary. The second point, and this is a little strong, is as important as Sarbanes is, it's also been a real detriment to commerce. It's a regulation that makes it very difficult for businesses to see the light of day because it costs so much money on the administrative side. So, query, what if we were able to take the position that in a democracy you can vote on what you want? Sarbanes-Oxley relates to corporations. Corporations have stockholders. What if the stockholders decided to vote to relax Sarbanes-Oxley to some degree? Because Sarbanes is there to protect the stockholders. It's a little bit of a stretch, a little difficult for people to conceive, but it's something that may work if the stockholders decide that they don't want it. Right now, that's in front of Congress, by the way. There's a new bill that's beginning to create the Sarbanes-Lite type consideration.
Let me remind our listeners, my name's Garland Nixon, and I'm right here with
Terry D. Kester.
And?
Mark Levine.
The late coming Mark Levine and our guest.
I'm not late yet. I'm still alive.
Right. Right. The late coming Mark Levine and our guest,
arriving.
Mr. Michael Roberts here, a businessman and entrepreneur extraordinaire. You listen to 89.3 FM WPFW. We are here at Ben's Next Door, 1211 U Street. Still plenty of time. We'll be here till 8 o'clock. Feel free to stop by. Terry.
Yeah, question.
You bleated.
I bleated.
Yes.
I beg your pardon. It was profundity and sagacity.
I think sheep bleat.
Yes, I know. Anyway, Mike, you were referring a lot here to small business, and there's probably the most misused term in politics today. I mean, in the sense that nobody really defines what a small business is, at what point is it a small business or a big business, and, you know, every politician says we're going to, you know, restore small business all over the place. But the really small startup businesses aren't capable of hiring many people and providing many jobs to begin with. The only figure that I've heard that might define it, and I certainly want your perspective on this, is businesses under 500 employees. Anything beyond that is not a small business anymore. Is there a definition besides the politicians' mythological definition?
And let me throw something in with that. And what level, in your opinion, what level of businesses are there that actually create the jobs?
Because exactly.
The,
that's
the
what
big
I'm,
corporations
the
now, the major corporations, even when they hire, which most of the time they're laying off, but even when they hire...
They hire people in China and India, Garland.
They're bringing people...
Mexico.
Even the major corporations that do hire, they're bringing back numbers that they've laid back, so that they've laid off in the past. So... What is
and
a small,
at lower wages.
What is a small business, and where are the jobs created, in your opinion, in our economy?
All right. First of all, the small business definition changes in the federal government from department to department. I remember when we had when we were going after our licenses for our wireless phone company, and at the beginning, it was going to be for minorities and women. In that case, we were able to identify a category. Then they decided that after one of the lawsuits, I can't recall which one it is, but it required that all contracts be basically race neutral and gender neutral. So they began to define a small business in the category of the FCC, which included rural telephone companies, which meant you had to be under $50 million. So suddenly the competition for those licenses that were between minorities and women all of a sudden jumped up under the definition of small business vis-a-vis the FCC. Garland, to your point, the average small business is about employees somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 people. The average age for a successful entrepreneur usually is a business that starts when you're in your 40s, contrary to popular belief. The successful. And, you know, if you look at new net jobs in America, mm-hmm. new net jobs, almost 100% are small business and entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are, you know, folks who have a dream. And I give a fair amount of speeches, and I always ask the question to everybody in a room, raise your hand if you have a dream or an idea of a business. And almost everybody raises their hand at that point. My next question is then, what's the first step when you have a dream, Garland? Is you've got to wake up.
Well said.
Then you need to sit up and stand up and go after it. And there'll be plenty of folks who are going to say to you, listen, maybe this is not such a good idea because some member of my family or your family tried to be an entrepreneur and look what happened to them. Well, we know that the mortality rate is fairly high for small business, but it is, in my opinion, the way this country is going to come back. And that's going to happen through innovation. Let me define that because that's a word that is used frequently. But for people to get the idea of what is innovation, let's use an example here. When Bill Gates created Microsoft, a lot of people think Bill Gates invented the computer. IBM invented the computers. Bill Gates was innovative by creating a software that ultimately led to us being able to use laptops. IBM slept on that. Then comes the internet, the AOLs, the Googles, the search engines.
which we can thank Al Gore and the government for helping in a major way to actually develop. I mean, it's funny, people joke about that, but he actually was a major force along with other people in the government to help business get that kind of infrastructure in place.
So that's the next level of innovation, the creation on top of the computer. And then they slept on the next one, which is, as we all know, Facebook and social networking. But as you can see, each of those are innovations on an initial entrepreneur's idea. You follow me?
Yeah.
People think that Ford created, built the first automobile. Ford did not. It was built and created in Europe. But what did he do? He was innovative. Mass production.
Right.
Now, here's the next question then. What's the relationship to government to innovation and entrepreneurship? If you look at Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt only made his money after the government built railroads.
Right.
Rockefeller was able to have vertical and horizontal integration because of railroads. You follow me?
It's a nice word for monopoly, is what horizontal
integration is. That's for sure. But you know, today we need almost anything we can get. I think China is monopoly now, I think.
That's true. And good old Teddy Roosevelt broke up that monopoly, and that's one of the things that Obama was talking about recently.
So if we look at the role of government in entrepreneurship and rebuilding this country and innovation, then we begin to we should now understand. I mean, for example, GE could not have built and would not have been able to sell toasters to rural America until TVA came along, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and put an electrified rural America, right?
Sure.
So if we look at today's world, and I'm sort of a futurist, and as you know, I wrote a book, Action Has No Season. If you look at, well, what are the future opportunities for business and government, we see that business has done things like allowed for the building of infrastructure for rural broadband.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, we have to look at some of the core inner city areas to make sure that that access to the internet exists where it doesn't exist today. Now, how important is that? 50% of the Fortune 500 companies put 100% of their jobs online. So if you don't have access to the internet, you also don't have access to what?
Jobs.
Exactly.
Fast food restaurants now, even Pizza Hut, they all have their jobs online.
Yeah. Let me ask you something in relation to that, and we talked a little bit about it before the show, and that is the role and relationship with labor. Because you said small business is where the jobs are created. I've heard differently, but I'm not going to argue that with you. But
what they find is that small businesses create a lot of jobs when they first start up, when they're not making a lot of money, when they're not making – the ones that make $1 million, the ones that the Republicans talk about create very few jobs. It's the ones that are just starting up. They create all the jobs.
Which and most part are kind of
new jobs.
Those tend to be temporary just due to the rate of failure of small business. But let me ask this, because this is the core question in terms of restoring our economy. You've got new business out there, but the wages are keep going down. I just read the other day that people between older people between 45 and 60, if they get a job, if that's that they've been laid off, they will get a job at about 3/4 of their former salary. And as we know, like with Boeing in South Carolina, the employees there are down to like $7 an hour as opposed to 20 some bucks an hour in Seattle with the unions. So if the wages keep going down, even though small business may start a job or provide a job, how is that going to restore the economy?
And also, you mentioned Henry Ford and mass production. Another thing Henry Ford famously said is, I have to pay my workers enough to buy my cars. He understood that without middle-class wages being substantial enough, that people couldn't spend and the economy couldn't grow. So I just want to piggyback on Terry's question about middle-class wages.
Yeah, and my theory is, if you're going to work for Boeing, you should earn enough to buy a jet, right?
Or at least a seat on their plane.
I was about to say, you should be able to fly at least.
Well, I can tell you as a former jet owner, I owned two of them at one time, Roberts Aviation. It's best not to own your own plane.
Well, that's good because I don't. So
not me neither.
So you're ahead of the game.
Yeah, I'm ahead of the game.
let's approach it this way. There's a new normal, and we have to just face up to this new normal, and that is you're going to have to learn to do more for less. When I see people leaving college, not being able to find jobs, the only silver lining of all that is you might have to, in fact, start a job, start your own business. as an employer, you're usually the last one to get paid if you're lucky to get paid. So regardless of our opinions of what the old definition of middle class is and now was, we just have to face the reality that in a downturn economy that has a U-shaped recovery in this recession, you know, normal recessions are V-shaped. They come down and they go up like the shape of a V. We are in a U-shape. So it dropped down, and then it's low. It's a long, low drive at the bottom before it starts to turn back.
Kind of an L-shape, I think, right now.
Yeah, but as we know, and I'm sure you've seen here, and I don't know if it's happening in St. Louis or not, but with the Occupy movement and the whole 99% idea, that new normal doesn't seem to affect, obviously, the 1%.
Right, the 1% don't have to sacrifice.
I'm not sure it affects even the 10%. Right. It's affecting only the middle class and the poor.
In the last 30 years, the top 1%, their wages have tripled, while the other 99% have barely increased. Do you think that means that, therefore, that they should pay a greater share of the nation's taxes, for example? Someone's got to pay for these wars that Bush started. Or do you think that if the rich get richer, then enough will trickle down, that eventually some of us will get some drugs?
Oh, Mr. Reagan.
Well, I'm curious. Michael, what do you think?
I was on the Fox Business and like Garland's on a regular basis one time, and it was
apologies accepted.
Listen, I tell you, I probably should accept them indeed. But I was responding to Warren Buffett, who was on just before me, and Warren's position.
He's one of the few billionaires I like, by the way.
Warren's position was that the roughly 250 billionaires who made about $240 million last year should make sure that they are paying proportionally to their income. My response was, and they should, but how do you address it? You address it through the loopholes that they're using.
Sure.
And most of the folks
the hedge fund loophole, corporate jet loophole, excuse me.
Yeah, he doesn't have a corporate jet anymore. So
yeah, there you go.
That was a big deduction for you, though, wasn't it, Mark?
I stuck it down in a loophole. Is what happened. Yeah, I mean, it was a deduction at the time when I was making money, but that was back in the day. So if we look at, to me, much of those discussions is a lost leader. I mean, we absolutely should address it. You know, the Republicans flipped that discussion into we have a class system as a result of those discussions and all that kind of crap. You know, that's not what it's going to take to turn this country around. What we're going to have to do is drill down to the business opportunities and create innovation and an environment that allows us to grow our nation. Now, we need to focus on manufacturing again, for example. We have to learn how to celebrate our entrepreneurs. We don't do enough of that. We almost frown upon people who are in business when we should embrace those small business people and then raise them and make them feel comfortable. And then others who get involved later will say, I want to be like that.
Should we encourage corporations to keep jobs in America? Because let's face it, children in China will work for 12 cents a day. Most American workers won't work for 12 cents a day. Should there be incentives to tell corporations, hey, bring the jobs home, maybe tax the ones heavier that go abroad, stuff like that?
Yeah, tariffs can be a part of that process if the products are coming back in. But look, I mean, we are in a global economy. We got to face it. But we are the geniuses and the brains behind most innovation. We've recently done some things to protect our patents in a timeline. On this council that I'm on, you know, one of the things we learned when we first got on was that a patent could take between 2, 3, 4 years. About 6 months ago, the president passed a law, essentially, that says we have a rapid patent. And I got a report today from David Koppels, who's over the U.S. Patent Office, that they're actually, for a smaller fee, You can now get a reading within 3 months and have your patent within a year. Now we are competitive.
We're going to hate to stop you, but we are running up against the break here. We're going to take a break here very shortly. My name is Garland Nixon. You're listening to the Raucous Caucus. I'm here with
Terry D. Kessler
and
Mark Levine
and
Mike Roberts.
Mike Roberts. We are fortunate enough to have a very successful businessman here tonight. We're talking business. We're talking some wonky stuff, and we're talking about how we can rebuild the middle class. And
we got a lot of people here. We want to give you all a chance to ask some questions.
We've got a huge audience, and we want people to have a chance to make some statements too.
And, And we were, just a week ago, we had a show talking about abolishing capitalism.
All
Stay
right.
tuned.
That was Terry's
show. We're gonna abolish the whole show for about a minute. We'll be right back. This is the Raucous Caucus.
Please join Bread for the Soul, WPFW, and DC Public Library in our annual toy and book drive for children with HIV/AIDS or whose parents have HIV/AIDS. Beginning now, please drop off new, unwrapped toys and child-appropriate books to any branch of the DC Public Library by December 14th. Volunteers are also needed as drivers and delivery persons to deliver food baskets and toys on December 17th. To volunteer, please call 202-421-8608 or 202-488-3404. Help make a child's Christmas bright. Thank you.
Into the night and back to the Raucous Caucus.
Good evening and welcome back to the Raucous Caucus here on 89.3 FM WPFW. We're here every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Alternately, one week we're in the studio, so next week we'll be in the studio. We will be taking your calls, so be prepared to be a part of the Raucous Caucus via the phone line. I'm here with
Terry D. Kester
and
Mark Levine
and
Mike Roberts
and our guest Mike Roberts today. We're talking about a variety of things about business. Mr. Roberts. And for those of you who are just tuning in, Mr. Roberts is from St. Louis, Missouri, the same town as Terry.
Oh yeah,
but we're not
going to
hold that against him.
Meet me in. Are we ready? Yeah. Meet.
No,
me
no.
In?
Something good came of St. Louis after
darling,
all.
Darling, pause for a moment. Everybody, bow your head to the St. Louis Cardinals, the world champion.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Come on. And forget about the St. Louis Rams.
Yeah, we won't talk about that. We won't talk about the conversation.
No, no, no. Let's not talk about that.
Yes. Mr. Roberts has a number of businesses. He owns, how many TV stations do we have now?
Four.
Four television stations, a radio station?
A radio.
How many hotels?
12.
And I understand, what you own, Roberts Isle Resort. Can you tell us a little, let's talk a little bit about your business. What's Roberts Isle Resort in the Bahamas?
I'm the largest African American developer in the Bahamas. I have Roberts Isle, which is, I think people would know it as Nassau, if you will, but it's in a beautiful area. And,
aren't the people in the Bahamas African American? I mean, there's American, North America, right? Never mind. Go ahead, sir.
Quiet, Mark. Quiet.
Did you go to school, Mark?
Ever?
No. We would call them African Bahamians.
Okay. Very Caribbean. Afro-Caribbean.
So if you want to be politically correct, it's African United Statesans.
There you go.
We haven't been politically correct.
Now, and let's see. You've got Roberts. Tell us a little bit about some of your real estate ventures, your real estate holdings.
We've done quite a bit in downtown St. Louis with converting office buildings into loft apartments, residentials. We built Roberts Tower, which is next to our Roberts Mayfair Hotel, which is one of the most beautiful hotels in St. Louis, just a block away from the front door of the convention center. And my brother Steve and I built the Roberts Tower, which is about a 54-unit all-glass building that we hope to see available for sale within the next year or two. There's some things you have to do now, like button up your buildings and your investments when you know that if you were to further invest, it would be difficult from a economic environment. One of the things that was voted on today was a TIF in North St. Louis, which is the black area of St. Louis where I was born, just two blocks from the Victor Roberts building, the Osiris building. We were born in that neighborhood. We never left that neighborhood. Our offices are still there. And Garland, today the TIF Commission in St. Louis voted to approve a development we're going to do. We're going to take about 40 acres in North St. Louis along King's Highway between Delmore and Page. A lot of folks won't know that, or Martin Luther King, actually. And we're going to build about 750,000 square feet of renovation of buildings and another 250,000 of new construction. We have about three or four anchors. I was the first African American to serve on the and currently on the International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSC, which has about 70,000 members. And one of the great things there is, you know, you get a chance to meet those who are not only building the biggest shopping centers in the world, but those who are the tenants in there. So it's nothing like exposure. And I really have to emphasize that to those who are listening. And we have to be involved. We have to join organizations and volunteer to be a part of it, because if you don't gather that type of information, you won't get that in school.
Michael, I'm curious to know what you think of another pioneering African-American who happens to be president of the United States. You've probably heard of him. No, seriously, what's your view of Barack Obama? How's he helping business, in your view? You mentioned the patent, which is interesting because a lot of people don't talk about that. That certainly helps business. What's your view?
Well, he's very dedicated to small business and innovation. Very dedicated to that.
Why isn't that story getting out and not just on Fox Business?
Well, let me say that I think that there are certain larger global discussion points that's going on right now that makes it difficult for that type of information to circulate. So it takes talk shows and guys like you who actually research and learn it to talk to discuss it and speak to that. You have to be that voice. He's actually said it before many times, but it may be in his State of the Union address, and it'll get mixed into a variety of other things that are being said. Those of us who are listening to those to that point, waiting for that information, we actually hear it. For example, one of the things that we're pushing, and when I say we, it's this council I serve on and the president of the White House, is the creation of entrepreneurial economic ecosystems. For us to build organically, we have to create in this country ecosystems, economic ecosystems, so that businesses and like-minded people who are thinking in the same way can come into a park or area and develop their ideas and cross-fertilize. If you look at Silicon Valley, that is an economic ecosystem. For those of you, for example, let's use an old school Detroit. Why is the automobile business all in Detroit? Because it was an economic ecosystem. People could exchange ideas. Manufacturers could supply various automobile companies at the same time. So what I think we're going to see around the country is more of these environments for people who are thinking if we're going to get into green technology, green fuel technology.
And Obama's healthcare. Done a lot on that.
Question. I noticed that when I was reading up on one of your developments, I believe it was Robert's Home, something we talk about, green technology, that you used, I believe it was built with sustainable materials. Right. You had, I believe, taken a number of, was it geothermal heating?
That's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. And LEED, are they LEED certified?
They are.
Good.
Although
Thank
LEED
you.
Is not technically usable for homes. The Home Builders Association have their own comparable definition, although I have two gold LEED certified projects on my commercial side of things. Thank you for asking that question, because it's something that's very important. We do use geothermal heating and cooling. We also created our walls are insulated with a styrofoam product. So imagine going from the footings all the way up to the very ceiling with styrofoam on each side and then pouring concrete in the middle. Our floors, we use bamboo. Our cabinets are bamboo. Recycled materials for our countertops. And a home this size, normally in an environment like St. Louis, would have a heating and cooling bill of about $300 a month. The heating and cooling bill for this is somewhere between $50 and $60
wow.
a month.
Wow.
And let me just impressive. Point out there, too, because I don't think people are aware, when we talk about geothermal, you know, the general image is you got to be sitting near a volcano to get geothermal. That's not true at all. All you need to do is go down a few feet, extend pipes for a certain distance or a certain depth, and you get geothermal heating systems in any part of the world.
And should we go to our people?
Oh, well, yeah, it looks like we've got someone.
But we should let everybody
patiently
know.
Patiently waiting.
But we haven't announced it. We have a mic here so we can have questions, so you can get in line here.
And then we're going to have to get to the book. We're going to have to get to Mr. Roberts' book next.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go.
First of all, I haven't heard a genius in a long time. But I do.
Thank you.
Think,
thank
I thought you listened to the Raucous Caucus.
I thought you listened to the Raucous Caucus
yeah,
every
come
week,
on,
Terry.
Come
yeah.
on, Joe. I mean, Joe.
Come on now.
But you, sir, are, I believe, a genius. But the question I have is, in terms of if you were the president and you were a senator or a member of Congress and you wanted to create 14 million jobs for those who are out of work and then an additional 14 million jobs for those working part-time and those who've given up altogether, how would you do that? And then the second question is, if Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate economist, New York Times editorial writer, is saying we are now in a depression, does it not maybe necessitate that people like yourself, a community-minded, progressive business leader, could perhaps consider in the nation's capital holding a job summit with governors, mayors, city council members, corporate leaders, because that's not happening. And if we don't come up with a major new deal that builds on what Roosevelt did and builds on private sector kind of entrepreneur skills, we're not going to get out of this mess, and we cannot accept the new normal because that's the new abnormal and the new immoral. Thank you.
Here. All right.
Well, I think that's a very provocative question, and again, you know, it's complicated, but it can be answered in a variety of ways. I've already sort of launched the concept of creating economic ecosystems throughout the United States that will create high-growth businesses. And when you create high-growth businesses, you're on the road to recovery. You know, if we take this bit of history, 50% of the Fortune 500 companies started during a recession or a bear market. So those of us who are out there thinking about starting a business, this is the time to do it. Why? Because by 2014, we're going to see a significant uptick. And what you don't want to do is wait until there is an uptick before you start that business or fulfill your dreams.
Why do you say 2014? Sense. What's going to change?
The cyclical concept of the economy. We've been doing some research on the hotel side. We believe that this year we thought we would be able to get occupancy up. We didn't, but we got rate up. Next year we're expecting to see occupancy move in the right direction, blended with rate. And then by 2014, we hope to see a pretty strong indication of recovery by 2014.
Very interesting concept here that certainly never dawned on me. I guess that's why you're a major businessman and I'm a radio talk show host. But at any rate, and that is the idea that if we think about stocks, you want to buy stocks when the market is low, as so when it grows, your stocks go up. So if you want to start a business, you start a business when the economy is weak.
Interest rates are low. Certainly, everything is cheap. People need jobs.
Tough to start, but if you can maintain it, as the economy goes up, quite naturally, your business will increase.
And yet corporations are sitting on more than $2 trillion in uninvested cash.
Well, we want to move, because there's something very important. I want to talk about your book. Action Has No Season. We certainly don't want to. The name of the book, Action Has No Season, by Mike Roberts. And where is it available?
Well, you can buy it online, Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Pretty much you can walk into any bookstore. They can pull it up on the computer. Or you could go to MichaelBRoberts.com and pull it up off of my internet. Let me jump back just for a moment.
Okay,
I want to
sure.
get deeper into the book.
Certainly.
But part of our recovery is going to have to address this issue. If we are at unemployment of somewhere in the 9% range, I think we're just
8.6 now.
Yeah. 4.4% of the those with a college degree are unemployed. 14% of those without a degree or less are unemployed. That begs, and so blended, that's where you get to the 8.6. But that begs the question, doesn't it? It says that we have to address the issue of a more educated workforce in order for this country to make a change. So when you look at what's happening in our high schools and the dropout rate and the availability of students, especially if you look in the minority communities and the disproportionate dropout, without us finding ways to address that so we have an intelligent group of workforce at the end of the day, we will, even for those entrepreneurs who are building businesses, are capitalists like me that are trying to increase our valuation, without that strong educational component, we're going to have a hard time. While over in India, you know, they have the equivalent of their MIT creating engineers. So what we have to do is look at, well, what is it going to take to grow this nation? So we have to have STEM-educated people, science, technology, energy, and math. So we have to look at what are the businesses, the green businesses, healthcare. In a little bit, we're going to have 30 million people who don't have healthcare today eligible for it. So query, where are all the clinics that's going to absorb those people? Who's creating the technology so it's a paperless environment to allow that to occur?
Let me throw in a big challenge since you mentioned that. And, you know, I'm not opposed to capitalism, and, you know, I believe in education.
Didn't you have a show
about
abolishing
capitalism? And we resolved it, too.
All right, okay. You know,
and the basic point was capitalism has to change. It can't be the capitalism that we have today. But my question is, you mentioned healthcare, and yes, there's going to be a great need in there, but it seems to me that it's obvious that the reason our healthcare system is a disaster that it is because of private industry and because of the fact that it's profit-driven constantly on every single level, be it a doctor, be it a drug, or whatever. So are you willing or do you believe or should businessmen understand that there are certain areas, certain services that provided to the people that should not be for profit? I mean, it used to be that even utilities were not, you know, they were for profit, but it was regulated on how much the profit could be. Today, the profit is driving everything, and it's destroying our healthcare system as the prime example.
Yeah, I don't think socialized medicine means socialism. And
I think most people like their Medicare. You know, call me crazy. I think actually most corporations don't want to pay workers' health benefits. They just assume the government handle it.
So how do we solve this? How do we get back to this public service idea?
Well, I think, you know, at the end of the day, frankly, you know, when we have our health program kick in, things are going to change. We're going to see opportunities galore. So people now have to start thinking a little bit about where are those opportunities and how do I plug myself in to those business opportunities. Capitalism from a laissez-faire perspective is okay, but it needs this new capitalism, the kind that I consider myself a capitalist, is one with a conscience. So we have to, in fact, be able to create, thank you, we have to be able to create a methodology for us to give back or be a part of the community so that we're able to build like I'm doing in the inner cities.
But here's my problem, all right? You clearly have a conscience. Most people in your position, I'm sorry to say, do not. So it seems to me that you can hope that people have a conscience. You can hope that businessmen pay their workers enough. And yet we find that many people are simply firing American workers and using child labor in China because it's cheaper. So given that, I would argue the minority of
Newt Gingrich just proposed to have child labor here. So
well,
that
that's right.
That.
Gingrich,
yeah,
that's right.
We could address that problem.
Given that I would argue the minority of people have a conscience, as you do, what incentives can the government do to encourage businesses to do the right thing they should do anyway with an environment, with labor, with health care, with all the rest?
I mean, there are some incentives, and a lot of those incentives relate to tax benefits and contributions to certain not-for-profits and things along that line. Listen, we can sit back and throw stones all we want, or we can embrace the system as we know it and try to clean it or cure it. If you have cancer, you know, you can't sit here and say, okay, I have cancer. Hey, y'all, give me another body and let this one go to rot. We have to cut it. We have to analyze it. We have to find a way for us to clean it or cure it. And if we don't, we are going to continue to be in this cycle.
But isn't that what Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank and all these bills are attempting to do? They're trying to say, hey, corporations, you can't commit fraud. If you sign something, you have to stand behind it. Would you invest in a company that didn't obey Sarbanes-Oxley?
Okay, Mark, I hate to cut you out, only got 10 minutes left, and we've got to talk about the book. I really want to find out.
Isn't Mike joining us next week, too? Staying and just being a...
Oh, that's right. He'll just stick around and become a regular member of the Raucous Club.
I respect the fact that he's willing to show up in front of the three of us and answer some tough questions.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book. Okay. Action Has No Season is the name of the book. What does that, what does the title of that book mean?
Well, it's really an existential concept. I always make the point that every day when we wake up, we're given 86,400 seconds. That's 24 hours for those of you who are trying to do the math right now. And in every moment that you exist, the moment you think of the moment, it's already gone. So we need to therefore maximize our moment and our existence. That's why action has no season is symbolic of the concept, you see. I also drive and created a word. It's the actionaire. And I hope we can adopt that all over the country. The actionaire is one who takes their ideas, their dreams, their vision, their sense of purpose, and they pursue that or those with courage and confidence and bravado, the actionaire. We have to be actionaires in America. We have to be actionaires in business. We have to be actionaires within our family and our relationships. You know, I make the argument that people need to recognize that, that being rich is not necessarily what you should pursue, because I see this all the time. People faking to be rich. They might have gold around their ears, their nose, their toes, and don't have $20 in their pocket. I would rather see you aspire to be wealthy. Wealth deals with sustainability for your family and your community. As I always say, you know, one of the things that I mentioned, and I'm sure most of the people listening really never heard of the Roberts Brothers in St. Louis. I get it. But the reason you haven't heard of the Roberts Brothers in St. Louis is because rich people scream, but wealthy people whisper.
Oh, thank great, you. Great, great.
And I would hope we could sustain the middle class as well.
Okay, we have a question from one of our illustrious audience members. We have two, and we have Ken after that.
Okay, I'll be brief. I did come late. My apologies. In hearing about the model, I am wondering how holistic is it in terms of the whole country? For instance, does it involve at all any reservations where indigenous people live? And how close to the Paris model are you creating cities where the wealthy people live in the center and the poor people are pushed to the ends of this, you know, the city circle with very little services and very little hope?
Well, she raises a good point. You know, back in the 60s, they had something called urban renewal. And urban renewal did exactly the same thing. It pushed poor people who were migrating deep in the downtown area, and it started pushing them out. And the further out they pushed, what we found was that there was regentrification that was taking place, and we see that now. In the very homes that your grandmother owns, that you are so important that you can't live or maintain that home, I submit to you that, you know, your grandparents spent a lot of time and your parents paying off those loans. They, you know, worked when the snow was falling. They worked when it was hot as hell outside. And then all we do is turn around and walk away from that investment in those homes, only to find that that's going to be some of the most expensive, valuable property on the face of the earth. Because everybody around the country, we're finding, are starting to move back into the core inner city areas. And I might add, people from around the world all want to live in the United States, contrary to popular belief. And when they do, they're going to go right back into your grandmama's house that you allowed to go for back taxes. Don't you let your mama's house go for back taxes. Hold on to it, sustain it, and make it happen. Indigenous people, I think that we have to look very closely at the Native Americans here, because, you know, that to me is still, for all practical purposes, you know, a plantation where they are living and how they are living, notwithstanding those who end up owning casinos and doing very well. Unfortunately, they are not necessarily having much of their success fall into some of the tribal areas. But that's a very unique and challenging issue, because they are all separately, they're autonomous, And until they can organize and create a stronger relationship between tribes so that they can use their financial strength and eventually get their voting strength together so that they can have a voice. But I believe that this president would be very open to doing what's ever necessary to help our indigenous folks come about and strengthen their position in America.
Thank you. We have one more. Ken, you're last up.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad I'm last up. the question I have, it would be kind of simple, I guess. The thing is, I heard you speak on capitalism and you said democracy. I think democracy is our problem. Capitalism is the second problem. Democracy, one thing, is controlled by a group of people. We need to be republic. We started on a republic, and you have several presidents. Woodson was one of them. Each time they talk about changing the money, Kennedy, Lincoln, and another, I can't think of the other president that actually died to his dual death. When it came to the control of the people, that's when you saw a big change. But as long as we have this democracy, which we don't need, it's controlled by capitalists. And capitalists itself, the way you use it, you got etymology, you got terminology. It's your terminology you gave us, but it's not the terminology of the capitalist itself.
Thank you very much, Ken. And thank you for being a part of the Raucous Caucus. How much time we got left there? I think we only got about 3 or 4 minutes. So we're going to, once again, I'm going to let everyone know. My name's Garland Nixon. I'm here with
Terry D. Kessler.
And
Mark Levine.
And our special guest,
Mike Roberts.
And we are the Raucous Caucus. We're on every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Next week, we'll be back in studio. So get your fingers ready to dial. We're going to have a hot topic. We're going to have a lot of fun. And we want you to be a part of the Raucous Caucus.
I got one last question.
Oh, sure. Okay.
From Mike Roberts. A lot of people on the left, a lot of liberals, a lot of Democrats complain that Barack Obama is too close to Wall Street, that he's too close to business, that he's looking out more for corporations than for ordinary people. How do you what's your view on that?
I think that's a Republican conspiracy.
Really? Because people on the left complain about it.
Yeah. And the banks. I mean, the connection with the banks seems ominous.
Listen, Barack Obama is the president of the United States. To presume that he can't or should not have conversations with every sector and every component in this country is ludicrous. What do you mean by getting too close? I mean, you know, it doesn't ring because it's one of those.
Well, they say, "Where's our bailout?" That's what the Occupy movement will say. You know, the banks get bailed out, the auto industry gets bailed out.
In all due respect to the Occupy movement, I don't know that they actually have a clear definition and mission. I mean,
there are many of them, and they have very different views.
No, I agree, but I mean, I think it's a good American First Amendment opportunity to speak and have a voice, but say something. I mean, let's make sure that we understand exactly what they are trying to achieve. Otherwise, how do you get your arms around what is it that they're trying to accomplish?
Yeah,
I have to say this,
unfortunately, not the African American community hasn't very strongly embraced the Occupy movement. And I think the reason why is because the African American we model our revolutionary movements, for lack of a better term, with the civil rights movement. And there was very, very well organized, and there was a very clear mission. And I think the Occupy movement, for all its good intent, comes across with a message that says, we don't know what we want, but we want it now. I don't think that resonates well. Although, most people in my circles support them, there's just the confusion that doesn't allow them to reach out and fill in our
impatience of the time. Because, I mean, the civil rights movement didn't start with wanting, legal change and all that. It started out on buses. It started out in schools.
Well, I disagree.
It started out
on
the National Guard. It didn't start out with that clear a focus. This will achieve a focus. And one of the focuses has to be, which we talked about before, destroying managed capitalism, which is not the same kind of thing
that Mr.
Roberts is talking about. Managed capitalism is what's destroying the country by simply manipulating and moving money, creating nothing.
We're running out of time, but I think the civil rights movement knew exactly where it was going.
We got to get out of here. We've got to thank
Step outside.
Mark, who do we need to thank?
We need to thank David Kelly in studio. We need to thank
Daniel right here,
Daniel,
our superb engineer.
And we want to thank WPFW, Brother Ra, who follows us.
And we want to thank
everybody.
And certainly
Mike Roberts.
A hand for our audience, everyone.
Will Peace Rama Caucus. Lee for letting us be here at Ben's Next Door.
And we will caucus with you again next Tuesday at 7 p.m. Thank you.